If you'll get out your Bibles and turn to the book of Isaiah, we've come up to chapter 41 in Isaiah, and just in the way of a very brief review, we have just got through a kind of historical chunk where Isaiah goes into a historical narrative about some of the things that happened under King Hezekiah's reign. And that ended in chapter 39. And then in chapter 40, Isaiah kind of shifts to prophesying in preparation. His goal is to prepare the children of Israel, Judah, for their captivity in Babylon that's coming eventually. And that theme carries over throughout the rest of the book as we can track it. So we've come to chapter 41. In verse 1, Isaiah says, "Keep silence before me, O coastlands, and let the people renew their strength. Let them come near, then let them speak. Let us come near together for judgment." So that's kind of the thesis statement for chapter 41, right there in the first verse. The coastlands indicates that God's talking about heathen nations. Kind of throughout the rest of the book, really, especially in the next few chapters, when you see the people, that's going to be referring to God's people. When you see the coastlands or the nations, that's going to be referring to the other nations, heathen nations that aren't Israel. So he's saying he's going to enter into judgment with the heathen nations. He's going to pass a sentence on them. In verse 2, beginning, it says, "Who raised up one from the east? Who in righteousness called him to his feet? Who gave the nations before him and made him rule over kings? Who gave them as the dust to his sword, as driven stubble to his bow? Who pursued them and passed safely by the way that he had not gone with his feet? Who has performed and done it, calling the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, am the first, and with the last I am he." These verses right here, verse 2 through 4, that's talking about King Cyrus. He's not named until chapter 44 and verse 28, where it says, "Who says of Cyrus, 'He is my shepherd, he shall perform all my pleasure,' saying to Jerusalem, 'You shall be built,' and to the temple, 'Your foundation shall be laid.'" He's not named until later on, but as we remember from the beginning of the book, when Isaiah is talking about Assyria and the king of Assyria, he starts talking about them with descriptive things before he actually names the country that's going to come against Israel in judgment. So he's doing that same thing here with Cyrus. He doesn't name him until a couple chapters later, but he starts talking about him now. Raised up one from the east, that description fits Cyrus because he ruled in Babylon, but he was from Persia, which is east of Babylon. So there's the idea there that he's raising up one from the east of Babylon to eventually rule Babylon. Beginning in verse 5, it says, "The coastlands," so the heathen nations, "saw it and feared. The ends of the earth were afraid. They drew near and came. Everyone helped his neighbor and said to his brother, 'Be of good courage.' So the craftsman encouraged the goldsmith. He who smooths with the hammer inspired him who strikes the anvil, saying, 'It is ready for the soldering.' Then he fastened it with pegs that it might not totter." The idea here kind of goes back to the last chapter, chapter 40. If you start reading in verse 19 and 20, it goes back to that making of idols. So remember, God's entering into judgment here with the heathen nations. And in verse 5 it says, "The heathen nations' coastlands saw it and feared." So they see him raising up this one in the east, this great work that he's going to do that he talks about in verses 2 through 4. And then in verses 5 through 7, he talks about the people of the heathen nations joining together, encouraging one another, and trying to build stronger idols. The craftsmen are encouraging the other craftsmen, and they're working together, trying to build their images stronger in fear. In verse 8, It says, "But you, Israel, are my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the descendants of Abraham, my friend, you whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from its farthest regions and said to you, 'You are my servant, I have chosen you and have not cast you away. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand.'" So starting in verse 8, Isaiah, God through Isaiah, gives some assurance to Israel, to Jacob. And he first thing he does is he brings in those promises to Abraham. So, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the descendants of Abraham, my friend. He doesn't necessarily say, I still have to give you that promise of Abraham, but he brings that promise into the mind of any Hebrew who would have read this. And then he gives them further assurance. You are my servant, I have chosen you, and I will not cast you away. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, I am your God. I will strengthen you. There's a promise. I will help you. There's a promise. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. There's a promise. Remember, in the context of this, Isaiah's prepping them for captivity in Babylon. So they're about to go endure something. He says, I'm not going to forsake you here. I still am fulfilling these promises I made to Abraham. And these assurances, especially verse 10, those things are fulfilled in the protection and in the returning that happens under Cyrus's rule. And then in verse 11 it says, "Behold, all those who were incensed against you shall be ashamed and disgraced. They shall be as nothing, and those who strive with you shall perish. You shall seek them and not find them, those who contend with you. Those who war against you shall be as nothing, as a non-existent thing. For I, the Lord your God, will hold your right hand, saying to you, 'Fear not, I will help you.'" So he continues to give those assurances of deliverance. He's reiterating and reiterating that I'm not leaving you here. I'm going to be with you. Those who war against you eventually shall be as nothing, as a non-existent thing, there in verse 12. In verse 14, he says, "Fear not, you worm, Jacob, you men of Israel." Worm there is not used in a derogatory sense. If I called somebody "you worm," that's, you know, they would probably take offense to that. But here, it's just being used to describe their helpless state. They can't do anything for themselves. They can't protect themselves. They can't move around on their own. God is having to do all those things for them. So Jacob is a worm. So he says, "Fear not, you worm, Jacob, you men of Israel. I will help you, says the Lord, and your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I will make you into a new threshing sledge with sharp teeth." So there's kind of some imagery there. Remember, they would bring the grain to the threshing floor, and the oxen would tread that sledge over it, and it would crush it and sort out the things that needed to stay and needed to go, and that's how their farming process worked. So he says that he's going to make Israel into a new threshing sledge with sharp teeth. "You shall thresh the mountains," in verse 15, "and beat them small, and make the hills like chaff. You shall winnow them, the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwinds shall scatter them. You shall rejoice in the Lord and glory in the Holy One of Israel." So there's an illustration here that's being made about conquest. Israel is going to be the threshing sledge that beats down the mountains and the hills, and they're going to overcome in that sense. That's the illustration. They're going to be overcoming and conquering, but it's a spiritual conquering. There's no record at this point in history on. There's no record of Israel or Judah, either nation, conquering physically by taking over other nations. At this point, they're done with that. The spiritual kingdom is being prepared. And that's that spiritual conquering that's coming. Beginning in verse 17, it says, "The poor and needy seek water, but there is none. Their tongues fail for thirst. I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers in desolate heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar and the acacia tree, the myrtle and the oil tree. I will set in the desert the cypress tree and the pine and the box tree together, that they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Lord has done this and the Holy One of Israel has created it. So these verses are highly figurative. God's not literally planting trees in the land or making new water sources in the land, but the illustration is that those things symbolize peace, prosperity, comfort, blessings for God's people. When, remember, they're preparing to go into captivity, he's saying, that's not going to last. You're going to be delivered. You're going to conquer spiritually in the last section of verses. And then in this section of verses, he's telling them there's going to be the peace, the blessings. And he illustrates that by water and plants in a barren and desolate land. It also has kind of a deeper fulfillment in Christ. This is one of those prophecies that you can read at face value and then go a little deeper and a little deeper and a little deeper. And it just gets more interesting, and you see God's authorship there. Jews had a particular relationship with God providing water for them. They celebrated that. In the Feast of Tabernacles, they would celebrate the fact that God had provided water for them in the wilderness of Sinai. And any Jew, any Israelite that would have been reading this text when it was written for them would have made an association between God providing water and that feast and that time in their history when God had provided water. They celebrated it throughout. And then in John chapter 7, when Jesus reveals himself at the Feast of Tabernacles, he goes to it and he talks to people there. He, in a sense, demonstrates to them, explains to them that he is the water of life, that he is that water that they've been celebrating that entire time. So you can go into that prophecy and study that out. It's a really interesting study. Beginning of verse 21, he says, "Present your case, says the Lord. Bring forth your strong reasons, says the King of Jacob." So he's maintaining that theme of come near together for judgment from chapter 41 and verse 1. But then here in verse 21, he says, present your case. So I've presented my case. Present your case. Bring forth your strong reasons, says the King of Jacob. Verse 22, let them bring forth and show us what will happen. That them being pagan idols. Let them show the former things what they were, that we may consider them and know the latter end of them, or declare to us things to come. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that you are gods. Yes, do good or do evil, that we may be dismayed and see it all together. Indeed, you are nothing, and your work is nothing. He who chooses you is an abomination. So God's essentially saying, all right, you pagan gods, you idols, do something. Show me you're real. Do good or do evil, tell the future, tell the past, do something to show us that you are real. But they can't, because they are nothing. And that's the conclusion in verse 24. Indeed, you are nothing, and your work is nothing. He who chooses you is an abomination. In verse 25, he says, I have raised up one from the north, and he shall come from the rising of the sun. He shall call on my name. He shall come against princes as the mortar, as the potter treads clay. It's interesting because this is also referring to King Cyrus. There's two reasons why I believe it's referring to King Cyrus, and I'll present that to you. The first reason is, on the slide behind me, Cyrus is from Persia, so he's from Persia, which is east of Babylon, but he took Media first. So he went from Persia east. That's not east to you. This is east to you. Went from Persia east, if Babylon's here, went north to Media. So he's raising up one from the north as well to take Babylon. So the geography fits. Also, there's a pattern in the chapter where he says in verse 1, keep silence before me, O coastlands, let the people renew their strength. Let them come near, then let them speak. Let us come near together for judgment. So he says, going to enter into judgment with the heathen nations. I've raised up one from the east. then the pattern fits, starting verse 21 through verse 24, essentially saying, present your case, you idols. Let's come near together for judgment. And then verse 25, I've raised up one from the north. So that pattern fits, and it would make sense for him to be talking about the same person there. And then beginning in verse 26, it says, who has declared from the beginning that we may know, and former times that we may say he is righteous? Surely there is no one who shows. Surely there is no one who declares. Surely there is no one who hears your words. The first time I said to Zion, look, there they are, and I will give to Jerusalem one who brings good tidings. For I looked, and there was no man. I looked among them, but there was no counselor who, when I asked of them, could answer a word. Then verse 29, indeed, they are all worthless. Their works are nothing. Their molded images are wind and confusion. So again, God gave the idols an opportunity. He gave the people who followed the idols an opportunity, but no one answered, no one showed, no one declared. And the verdict that God comes to here is, indeed, they are all worthless. Verse 29, their works are nothing. Their molded images are wind and confusion. But if we just step back from the chapter, zoom out a little bit, we see two themes going right now. There's God is setting himself up against the idols and, you know, winning in a landslide. And he's also reiterating, I've prepared someone to save you from this captivity. I'm raising up one from the east. I'm raising up one from the north. So it's kind of a dual theme through the chapter. God is greater than the idols. The idols are nothing. And God is raising up Cyrus in order to save his people. And then we get to chapter 42. God's servant is described in the first four verses. He says, behold, my servant whom I uphold, my elect one, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the Gentiles. He will not cry out, nor raise his voice, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench. He will bring forth justice for truth. He will not fail nor be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands shall wait for his law. So, right off the bat, we notice that there's a change in what Isaiah is talking about. The character of this servant doesn't fit Cyrus. It doesn't fit King Cyrus. King Cyrus was a conqueror, a man of war. Certainly it wouldn't say of him, he will not cry out or raise his voice, a bruised reed he will not break. Okay, this is a much more gentle person, much more gentle nature. But there's still overcoming. My elect one in whom my soul delights, I put my spirit upon him, he'll bring forth justice to the Gentiles. And then in verse 4, he will not fail nor be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands shall wait for his law. And so there's meekness, there's conquering in the same being. Who does that remind you of? Reminds me of Jesus. And we know that this is about Jesus because in Matthew chapter 12, and we'll start in verse 15. It says, but when Jesus knew it, he withdrew from there, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them all. Yet he warned them not to make him known, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul is well pleased, or my elect one in whom my soul delights, from the passage in Isaiah. Verse 19, he will not quarrel nor cry out, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench, till he sends forth justice to victory, and in his name Gentiles will trust. So we know that that's about Jesus because an inspired writer in the New Testament says so. Verse 5 is neat to me. He says, thus says God, the Lord who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread forth the earth and that which comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk on it. He's kind of sealing what he's about to say with his nature. Remember from chapter 40, he did that in a much more grand and explained way, where he talked about how, he said, I'm greater than all of the creation. I'm greater than all of the nations. I'm in control of everything. I established knowledge. I invented understanding. And then here in verse, and then he says some things that he wants to be sealed by his nature. It's the seal of that promise. Same idea here. He says, thus says God the Lord, the creator of the heavens, who stretched them out, who spread forth the earth and that which comes from it, who gives breath to people on it and spirit to those who walk on it. In verse 6, I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness and will hold your hand. I will keep you and give you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the Gentiles, to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the prison, those who sit in darkness from the prison house. I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory I will not give to another, nor my praise to carved images. Behold, the former things have come to pass, and new things I declare. There, before they spring forth, I tell you of them. So, again, Jesus fits nearly every aspect of this. In verse 6, says that he is going to give you as a covenant to the people. Jesus is a covenant to the people. A light to the Gentiles. You can go read in Ephesians chapter 4. Actually, I think we read that at some point later on in the chapter. Yeah, we do. When we get to verse 16, we'll read that. But in Ephesians chapter 4, it talks about the Gentiles being given light who were once in darkness. And verse 9, even, declares that there's a coming transition from old things to new things. And Jesus is going to be the instigator of that transition. It says, behold, in verse 9, the former things have come to pass, and new things I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. In verse 10, a new covenant requires a new song. And the reason we know that this song is pertaining to that new covenant is because of who's included in it. In verse 10, it says, sing to the Lord a new song and his praise from the ends of the earth. But notice this part. You who go down to the sea and all that is in it, you coastlands and the inhabitants of them. So remember that in this context, Isaiah is using that to talk about the Gentile nations, the heathen nations. You coastlands and you inhabitants of them are joining in this song. Verse 11, let the wilderness and its cities lift up their voice, the villages that Kedar inhabits. Let the inhabitants of Selah sing. Let them shout from the top of the mountains. Let them give glory to the Lord and declare his praise in the coastlands. The Lord shall go forth like a mighty man. He shall stir up his zeal like a man of war. He shall cry out, yes, shout aloud. He shall prevail against his enemies. So, there on down through verse 13, really from 11 to 13, we get a kind of picture of, again, expanding borders, where there's going to be conquering, where there's going to be overcoming. And the Lord is pictured as a mighty man of war. He's zealous, he's like a man of war, he shall cry out and shout aloud, and he will prevail against his enemies. Again, that's figurative, and it is spiritual overcoming. Not physical overcoming. In verse 14, it says, I have held my peace a long time. I have been still and restrained myself. Now I will cry like a woman in labor. I will pant and gasp at once. This is God speaking. And essentially, this language is just a roundabout way of saying, I'm about to do something. I'm going to act. Verse 15, he gives information on what that act is going to be. I will lay waste the mountains and hills and dry up all their vegetation. I will make the rivers coastlands and I will dry up the pools. So there's going to be a coming of judgment. That's what that language indicates. And then there's verse 16. I will bring the blind by a way they did not know. I will lead them in paths they have not known. I will make darkness light before them, and crooked places straight. These things I will do for them, and not forsake them. Verse 17 says, they shall be turned back, they shall be greatly ashamed who trust in carved images, who say to the molded images, you are our gods. So there's a distinction here made between, in 16 and 17, made between Gentiles who follow that spiritual kingdom and Gentiles who don't. So in verse 16, those Gentiles, he's going to bring the blind by a way they did not know. Even though they didn't see at first, they're going to be brought along. He'll make darkness light before them. They're going to be given light and crooked places straight. And he's not going to forsake them. Those fall into that category in Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 17, the people Paul is talking to, he says, this I say therefore and testify in the Lord that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of the God because of the ignorance that is in them. Notice this part, because of the blindness of their heart. So, right there, Paul says, you've been called out of that, Gentiles. You've been given light. The other Gentiles are still in that same darkness, in that same blindness. They haven't been brought out of it yet. Verse 18, beginning, it says, hear, you deaf, and look, you blind, that you may see. What's interesting about that verse is that it shows us that it is a self-imposed condition. I stole that self-imposed condition. It's fancy words for me, but I stole it from a commentary. I won't take credit for it. It's the idea that they're blind because they're choosing not to look, and they're deaf because they're choosing not to hear. It's not a situation where they are unable to hear or they are unable to see entirely, but that they're choosing not to do those things. In verse 19, it says, who is blind but my servant, or deaf as my messenger whom I send? Who is blind as he who is perfect, and blind as the Lord's servant, seeing many things, but you do not observe, opening the ears, but he does not hear. Servant, messenger, and servant again in verse 19, that's not the same servant from verse 1. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, my elect one, in whom my soul delights. Not the same servant. The servant in verse 19, the messenger, and then servant further on in verse 19, that's talking about Israel, Judah, the people, not Jesus. But the idea here that God's people are just as deaf and blind, even though they've had ample opportunity and teaching upon teaching, prophet after prophet, in order that they should be able to see and they should be able to hear, but they still don't. And it's, again, a self-imposed condition. They choose not to. They see many things, in verse 20, but they do not observe. They open their ears, but they do not hear. In verse 21, it says, the Lord is well pleased for his righteousness' sake. He will exalt the law and make it honorable. But this is a people robbed and plundered. All of them are snared in holes, and they are hidden in prison houses. They are for prey, and no one delivers, for plunder, and no one says, restore. So, verse 21, the Lord is well pleased for his righteousness' sake. He'll exalt the law, make it honorable. God's law is just and honorable and fair and righteous, and he's pleased with it here in this context. But the people are robbed and plundered. And it's because of verse 20. They see many things, but they do not observe. They open their ears, but they do not hear. They've chosen to put themselves in a situation where they don't reap the benefits of having that righteous, just law that God gave them. In verse 23, we see their action and consequence. It says, who among you will give ear to this? Who will listen and hear for the time to come? Who gave Jacob for plunder and Israel to the robbers? Was it not the Lord, he against whom we have sinned? For they would not walk in his ways, nor were they obedient to his law. Therefore he has poured on them the fury of his anger and the strength of the battle. It has set him on fire all around, yet he did not know, and it burned him, yet he did not take it to heart. So there in verse 23 and 24, God gave Israel to their punishments. Who gave Israel to their punishments? I did. That's what God says. Why? Because they sinned. They would not walk in his ways, nor were they obedient to his law. That we learned in verse 21 is righteous and just and perfect. And he's well pleased in it. It's honorable. But they would not walk in it. They were not obedient to it. Verse 25, there's the consequence. He has poured out on him the fury of his anger and the strength of the battle. And then the second half of verse 25 is interesting to me. It says, it has set him on fire all around. That fury and anger of God and the strength of the battle has set Israel on fire all around. So the consequence is there. Israel sinned. God gave the consequence for that. But he did not know. And it burned him, and he did not take it to heart. I've experienced it. I've seen this happen recently. I put Easton in timeout today for trying to get through the baby gate, right? And I picked him up, put him in his crib, just like I was supposed to. And he cried for like half a second, and then he didn't remember a thing. And it was a little frustrating on my end, because there was the action, and I did the consequence, but he didn't take it to heart. He didn't learn from that experience. That's what God experienced there with Israel. Do you have any questions or comments?
We're all kind of slow to learn.
I certainly am. Certainly, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he is talking about some of their physical help that's coming, but it's kind of woven into it with the spiritual stuff. And it would have been hard for them to pick that apart then. Yeah, certainly. Makes me appreciate having the New Testament writers to, you know, to say, this is about Jesus. We can go and look, and it's there. They quote it. Very helpful. Well, that's where we will end for this evening. There's an invitation now if anybody needs prayers or would like to obey the gospel. This is the time for those things. You just come forward to the front pew. We'll talk to you while we sing the invitation song. So if you have a need, please let it be made known while we stand and sing.